Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations on the exchange, well, you can do that too. Phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We make jokes about being ready for the old folks' home, but the jokes probably hide an inner fear, a fear of living out our final years in somebody else's care in a place we do not think of as home. When asked, the vast majority of Americans say they would like to spend their retirement years in their own homes, the process known as aging in place. And it is a little more complicated than simply staying put, a little more than simple inertia. Today's guests wrote the book on what to do. It is called How to Age in Place, Planning for a Happy, Independent, and Financially Secure Retirement. Our two guests are Dr. Mary Langerand and Dr. Robert Bornstein. They're both trained clinical psychologists. Dr. Langerand now practices on Long Island, and Dr. Bornstein is a professor at Adelphi University. They co-authored a pair of previous books, Healthy Dependency, Leaning on Others Without Losing Yourself, and When Someone You Love Needs Nursing Home, Assisted Living, or In-Home Care. So, Mary and Robert, welcome, and this seems like a logical follow-up to that book about needing nursing home care.
Thank you. Yes, it actually grew out of that work. We realized that we'd addressed the questions of how to deal with a nursing home, but we really hadn't looked at what happens to the rest of us who really want to stay in our own homes as we age.
Mary, for you in particular, since you're still practicing a psychologist in private practice, Robert's the professor at Adelphi, in your work, do you encounter a fair number of people who did not plan well for their later years?
I've encountered a lot of people who thought that they'd planned adequately and faced unexpected setbacks and things they just didn't think were going to happen, illnesses or setbacks in their financial state, illnesses in their loved ones, changes in their status, and a lot of them just wound up not having planned quite well enough.
And so the first story, for example, of Kate and Tom and her stroke and the stock market ruining them, I mean, is this a bit of a composite story, Bob Bornstein, or is this a fairly typical one?
Well, it's a unique situation, but what it illustrates, I think, is the fact that we become preoccupied with financial planning when we think about our later years. And oftentimes we neglect what seem like small details but can make a huge difference. In Kate and Tom's situation, it was that they were living in a home that just wasn't really amenable to being retrofitted for someone with limited mobility.
You did have me thinking about a bunch of things when Kate had a stroke, is that correct?
That's right.
All right, so she had to be in a wheelchair, and yet they discovered that a lot of the parts of their house were too narrow to fit wheelchairs through, and then apparently the kitchen itself was just an impossible place to get into.
Absolutely, and that's a very common situation. And the problem really is that we become so focused on the finances that we don't think about those other things, like our home, like also our neighborhood. Have to think about as you plan. Whether you can get around on foot if at some point you're unable to drive, whether you can get around using an assistive device if at some point you have difficulty walking.
Things to think about, like if you really love your house but you live on a steep hill in a neighborhood that gets really icy streets in the winter.
That's right, and that was our life in Gettysburg, and a lovely house, but not a place to be when you're 80 or 90.
So, Mary Langerand, I don't want to overthink this, but the concept of aging in place, is it fairly simple? You want to live where you live now, or is it a little broader than that?
Well, it's considerably broader than that. The object of the task isn't necessarily just staying in one place where you've always lived. It has a lot more to do with finding a setting and a locale that will allow you to live the life you want to live maximally. And that means having the social support, the health care, the services that you need so that you can do the things you want to do with the retirement years that you have. And when you think about the fact that you may have 20 or even 30 years post-retirement to enjoy your life, you really have to start thinking ahead in terms of what kinds of services am I going to need if I want to live in my community when I'm 85 or 95.
And Bob Bornstein, there are so many different categories you suggest thinking about. Once readers will crack open the book, they'll think, oh, wow, I didn't realize this was part of thinking about aging in place. But give us a bit of a rundown, if you would, on the things, the areas that people need to think about for aging in place.
Well, that's really a terrific question. Locale is certainly one of the key issues, but we've tried to frame everything around what we call the Access Opportunities Services model, the AOS model. Beyond finances, really you need to be thinking about three things. You need to be thinking about access, and that involves things like universal home design, that is perhaps setting up your home or moving to a new home that will allow you to live a good life even with some limited mobility or with cognitive decline. Access means thinking about public transportation. Access means thinking about neighborhood walkability as well. The opportunities part of the AOS model involves really putting yourself in a place. And as Mary said, I mean, aging in place doesn't mean you're stuck where you are. Aging in place means finding an ideal place to age. So the opportunities part of that may mean thinking about what sorts of recreational opportunities, cultural opportunities you want to have available in your 70s, 80s, and beyond. Educational opportunities, really one of the more cutting-edge kinds of trends that we're finding is that people want to move to places where they can take adult education classes into college and university towns.
All kinds of options for later life. We'll talk more with Bob Bornstein and Mary Langerand about how to age in place, planning for a happy, independent, and financially secure retirement. We'll return with them and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today, psychologists Dr. Mary Langerand and Dr. Robert Bornstein. They are the co-authors of the book How to Age in Place, Planning for a Happy, Independent, and Financially Secure Retirement. The vast majority of people, when asked about their later years, say, yes, I want to stay in my own home, but there are some things to consider before that, and this book gets you considering those. Join us on the Exchange with your comments, questions, your ideas. Perhaps you are aging in place already, and tell us about some of the steps you took. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about AOS, Access Opportunities and Services. I do want to come back to that. I also want to get into another acronym early on here, Mary Langerand. What are ADLs?
ADLs are activities of daily living. And they're the things that we do in the course of a day that enable us to live. So complex ADLs may have to do with being able to prepare meals or do our banking or our finances. Basic ADLs are things like being able to dress yourself properly, feed yourself, go to the bathroom independently. And as these functions are impacted by illness or advanced age, we may need more assistive devices or more assistance or more changes in the environment that would enable us to continue living independently in the community with a little bit of help. Your ADLs, or again, activities of daily living, are also a really important consideration in terms of insurance, long-term care insurance. Many people realize that as they age, they're going to need a little bit more help if they're going to stay independent. Long-term care insurance policies can be a really wonderful benefit in that they will allow people to to get some services, often in their own homes, that would allow them to continue to live independently with that little bit of help. And the policies often kick in when your ability to execute certain of these activities of daily living are compromised. So if you can't dress yourself, or you need assistance taking medication, or you need assistance taking a shower or a bath, depending on your policy, and this is extremely important because the devil's in the details, you must read your policy and know what it states. The policy may kick in to allow X number of hours of service if you are showing problems in two or three areas that are important in daily living. And it can be a wonderful resource in terms of giving you that little bit of help you need to stay in your own home a lot longer.
Who makes the assessment, though, about whether you're able to continue with some of your own ADLs?
Often the insurance company will either have its own nurse or physician. Sometimes they will ask for input from your physician, often both. It really depends on a number of things, including state law, policy, company. There's a number of parameters that would differ considerably from place to place. Again, the most important thing to keep in mind, read the policy before you sign, and if you don't understand what you're reading, get help before you sign on the line.
But Bob Bornstein, it sounds like even before you get to the point of long-term care insurance, you want to make a fairly rigorous and baldly honest assessment of what you have in your life now and what you're going to require as the years go on.
Honesty is key, both with respect to your financial situation and with respect to your medical history and your family history. Families aren't perfect predictors, but if you take a look at what your parents or your grandparents were like in their 70s and 80s, you can get some sense of the likelihood that you too may have a particular condition or something along those lines. So honest, early, forthright assessment is absolutely key. And let me add one other thing about ADLs. They're also a key determinant of the level of care that a person may need, either short-term or long-term. What distinguishes in-home care from assisted living care from skilled nursing care is fundamentally how many ADLs you can carry out on your own.
And are there societal benefits beyond the benefits just to the people who are aging in place?
Planning ahead of time?
Just of aging in place generally. I mean, it seems...
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Costs for elder care in the person's home are about 80% less than the same services rendered in a facility. So this is really not only something that's beneficial to the individual, but more broadly to society, and especially now, of course, that medical costs are being squeezed ever more. And so this is the future of late life really living.
Mary, the book wonders the same thing I wondered. If you have 89% of people surveyed saying they want to age in place, what do the other 11% want? Do we know yet?
We've all wondered about that. We don't really know. There are some people, a very tiny, tiny proportion, who seem to feel that life in a facility would be great because everything would be taken care of and they wouldn't have to worry about it. But the actual experience of facility living is often rather less ideal than even that tiny minority expect. The beauty of being in the community is that you continue to be within the stream of life. You're still out there seeing people, having relationships, having meaningful interactions, and losing that opportunity is just, in our opinion, a very great loss, both to the individual and to society.
The book, How to Age in Place, is divided in two major sections, Making It Work and Making It Count. Is the dividing line between the sections basically the point of retirement, that you're doing your planning and making it work, and then you're actually living it and making it count?
Well, it comes back to your earlier question, which was terrific, which is, what are people not thinking of early in the game? And in the sense that we tend to think of late life as a time of loss, and we tend to plan around, well, what am I going to do to be able to survive financially after I stop working? I think we forget the other half, the more important half, which is, this is a great opportunity. This is the time to do those things that you've been putting off for years, for decades, while you were working, while you were at the office and raising a family. So in Making It Count, we talk about both the sort of proactive things you can do to maintain your health and keep your mind sharp, but also those things you can do to stay connected with other people, to do the sorts of things like adult education that we had mentioned briefly before, that you hadn't had a chance to do before, and also opportunities to give back, to engage in charitable work and mentorship and civic engagement. This is your time. This is your shot.
Bob Bornstein and Mary Langerand, both psychologists, are joining us on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about their book, How to Age in Place, Planning for a Happy, Independent, and Financially Secure Retirement. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Cynthia in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
I like what you were just saying about helping to keep the communities healthy. I think our area has been labeled a good place to age in place. We seem to have a lot of elders here still young enough to volunteer, who do a lot of volunteering. And I want to put a plug in for volunteering in schools and libraries and other things that support the younger generation, partly because it's good to have that mix of elder and younger. Benefits both groups, but also to keep our community healthy so that we can attract young families as well as elders. And I think there's a healthy balance that we should strive for.
All right. Thanks for that, Cynthia. Appreciate it. Mary, you want to respond?
You're absolutely blessed to have such a wonderful, vibrant library community that welcomes the input of your senior volunteers. That is so necessary for communities, because I think another really important thing is that seniors can bring perhaps a deeper appreciation of some old school learning that might be getting lost in the shuffle these days.
So they will actually place a value upon their knowledge and their experience instead of just saying, "Eh, we're done with you."
Absolutely, because you get a lot of wisdom and perspective with age, and you've been around the block a few times. You kind of know the value of some things that you know will go on forever, like reading, like appreciating art, like storytelling. And what better venue than volunteering at a library or a literacy program? Your community really is lucky.
The first chapter in How to Age in Place is the chapter on money matters. Financial planning you call the bedrock here, but Bob Bornstein, this is, I imagine, somewhat tricky. You're basically trying to make sure that your life and your money run out at about the same time.
Right. That is a tricky thing, both in practical terms and in sort of self-reflection, because it does compel you to think about how much time you think you have left, and that's not something we dwell on too much of the time. But I'll tell you from our personal experience, and this is one of those unanticipated things, lots of people plan very well in terms of asset accumulation, and you know we've done our best in that area as well. And you put away money in your retirement plan, or you do what you do. Not that many of us have developed a plan for drawing down our assets it's not something that you can sort of wake up the day after you retire and say, okay, well, this is how I'm going to start to spend this money. It really requires planning, and at least as much planning as the asset accumulation part.
Really? So you have to plan that carefully for when you're letting things out, in addition to bringing things in the first place.
That's right, and there are a lot of unknowns in there. You know, we don't know what the inflation rate will be 10 years from now or 20 years from now. Of course, as you say, we don't know how long we're going to live, so we don't know how long we're going to need the money. So, of course, you know, everyone is different, and you have to develop a plan that works for you. But our thinking, of course, is, you know, you be a bit conservative, and as you say, you want to die with at least a bit of money in the bank. But there are a lot of nuances in the drawdown process. For example, you may have accumulations in a number of different areas. Which of your resources do you begin to draw from first? In what combination? And that sort of thing. So it's a tricky business. We talk quite a bit about it in the first chapter. And we do provide some worksheets for estimating both your assets and your liabilities and also your future expenses, and that's the place to start.
For the folks who haven't gotten into things like IRAs and Roth IRAs, can you tell us what the difference is and what the advantages are of either one?
They're quite different. I mean, they're both good savings vehicles. They're probably particularly helpful for different types of people. Probably the main difference between a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA is that in a traditional IRA, you're putting in money pre-tax, so you realize an immediate savings. If, for example, you are able to put in $10,000 a year, say, at work, that's $10,000 less income that you're paying tax on this year in 2013. So that's a huge savings, especially when you think it forward over 10 or 20 or 30 years. Roth IRAs, the money that's put into a Roth IRA is after tax. So you don't really realize any savings in the short term. Now, the advantage of the Roth IRA is that withdrawals, including the accumulations, the gains, are tax-free. And so you gain that in the long term.
So it's really a question of when you get taxed, either now or later.
That's right. So you have to make some estimates about, you know, what's my tax rate now, what's my tax burden now, what's it likely to be like when I begin to draw down that money in 10 years or in 30 years or whenever it's going to be. And it's trade-offs. And so for many people, a combination of the two is the appropriate way to go. And when you're making that level of decision, our recommendation is to start with the worksheets and with some good, honest self-reflection. And as you sort of narrow in on your chosen strategies, consult with a certified financial planner and get that vetted by someone who's got experience in this area.
And there's obviously some material in the book about the option of whether or not you want to continue to work in some capacity, maybe not at the job you retired from, but maybe to do something else. And, Mary, I guess it's not funny to the people who are experiencing this, but there is a new disorder psychiatrist discovered in Japan among retired people. Would you explain that?
Yes, there is. That would be called the retired husband syndrome. When a husband who has been away working long hours at the office suddenly comes back home and is spending a lot of time micromanaging his wife's household, there have been a number of cases of the wives attempting to kill said husbands. Unfortunately, there is such a thing as too much togetherness, and if you've never really thought through how will we be spending all those hours together, you may find yourself in a very interesting relationship transition point in a marriage, because a lot of the time you may have only spent a few hours a day together. If suddenly you're spending the better part of your waking hours together under the same roof, it really does change the relationship, the dynamics, and as the Japanese discovered, often the happiness with which you're going to deal with each other.
Do you recommend for people to work at least a couple of hours a day, a week, something?
Well, our thinking is that you want to plan some independent time, some apart time. Whether that be working is fine. Having separate friends, cultivating separate interests. It may be that one partner is a tennis player, or one person may play bridge. And there's a bit sort of a reflex to think, now we've got free time, so we should both play bridge. Well, you know, not always. It's important to have a little bit of separateness so that there isn't too much together time.
All right, we have much more to talk about with Robert Bornstein and Mary Langerand, both psychologists, the authors of How to Age in Place, Planning for a Happy, Independent, and Financially Secure Retirement. Many questions you may have, you can share those with us or your comments on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take your phone calls and emails when we come back from this break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today, psychologist Mary Langerand and Robert Bornstein. They're the co-authors of the book How to Age in Place, Planning for a Happy, Independent, and Financially Secure Retirement rather than going off into a nursing home or some other care facility. We've already established 89% of Americans would like to age in place. Obviously, not all can do it. The book deals with the preparations you need to make up to the moment and then maintenance once you're in that aging in place part of life. Join us on the Exchange with your questions or comments, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Bill and Eugene, welcome to the Exchange.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm interested in Ross, and I'm very happy with Ross, and I'd like to bring his attention to something. I am shocked by how many people in the United States have no idea about a Roth, and it's like the only really good financial avenue or conduit that the government gives us. I fell into it luckily, and it really saved my butt. But from what I understand, is you buy it with your tax money, taxed. The beauty of it is, you never pay taxes on the dividends. So if you have stocks, you don't have to pay a fortune for an accountant to figure out your buys and sells. That's one headache. And it just grows and grows and grows. And my question is that you can get the money out of a Roth. When can you get the money out of a Roth? The principal you put in. Just the principal, not the dividends.
Okay,
and
good question.
I believe you can get that 5 years. After 5 years you've had it, you can get the principal back with no charge. I'm having a mistake. That's why I'd like to have it answered.
All right.
And as far as the dividends or the income, I believe you can get that out three different times in your life. When you buy your first house, when you use it toward education, going to college, or major medical. And I'd just like to have that clarified.
All right.
And I believe the age that you can't take, you're charged 20% above those three times if you take it out before age 59 and a half. And I'd just like to have the answers on those.
All right, let's find out. Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate that. Bob?
Yes, that's a great question. Unlike a traditional IRA, Roth IRA contributions can be withdrawn with no penalty at any time. There are limits on how soon you can begin withdrawing earnings, and indeed 5 years, they must remain 5 years before you can begin drawing them down, or there's a penalty. And so you're right. There's more flexibility here than with a traditional IRA, but there are some limits as well. Keep in mind that they're likely to change. Laws get revised, so the best bet here is, one, to look at the IRS website as you make drawdown decisions. And if it gets complicated, consult with a professional. Now, the other thing to keep in mind in the context of that terrific question is in a traditional IRA, you must begin drawing down your savings at age 70 and a half. How they came up with 70 and a half, I do not know. But you have to begin drawing down your savings at age 70 and a half, or you begin to accumulate a penalty. There are no age-based distribution requirements for Roth IRAs, and so you have more flexibility in that regard as well, and unlike a traditional IRA, you can leave it all to your heirs, 100%.
Okay, interesting. So there are some significant differences there, obviously. Just to finish up the whole money section of the book, though, I mean, you say stay informed, get help, don't be a schmuck. A schmuck how?
Well, your financial planner is not your friend. Your financial planner is making their living by accumulating customers and working with them. We're not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that financial planners are dishonest people, but as in any profession, some are. And so if you're uncomfortable with the recommendations that the person is making, don't feel pressured to accommodate them. If someone is pressuring you to make a decision more quickly than you would like to make it, that should be a red flag to you. If someone is telling you that there's a particular opportunity, an investment vehicle that's available, but you have to decide today, that's a big red flag. Don't do it. There's no legitimate investment vehicle that you can't choose to invest in next week. And circling around all of that is, you'll notice in the book that we use the term certified financial planner a number of times. Anybody can call themselves an investment specialist. Anybody can call themselves a financial expert. Anybody can call themselves a late life elder care finance professional. But no one can call themselves a certified financial planner who is not properly trained, licensed, and keeps that license active in the state in which they practice. Certified financial planner.
All right, certified financial planner. I'll get that one drilled into our heads yet and keep it there. I want to move back onto the section we were talking about earlier, AOS, Access Opportunities and Services. Mary Langerand, is it really a case of needing to look at your house and your neighborhood with new eyes?
Yes, it absolutely is. When you first look at a house, you're probably looking at fireplaces and how many bathrooms do you have and how many bedrooms do you have. And as you start to think about aging in place, you're going to be more interested in, would I be able to access all these rooms if I were mobility challenged? Would I be able to reach the items in my freezer? Would I be able to get into the bathroom, and how would I transfer to the tub or the commode if I were paralyzed on one side, or if my balance were extremely shaky or my perception were impaired? These are the kinds of questions you have to start to ask yourself. And as you make a list, and we have some checklists in the book that help you to go through your home and evaluate the various areas, the kitchen, the bathroom, the outside, the vestibules, to see what might need done to make your home more accessible in the event of mobility challenges or perceptual challenges or even cognitive impairment.
And then moving outside of your home, you have to think about your proximity to things around you, whether you could walk to things. And there are some important considerations to be made here, like ending driving. At some point, you may decide you can no longer do this. What are some of the clear signs that you've had enough, short of actually crashing into things?
Well, there is crashing into things. There can also be the fact that other drivers will be giving you a lot of feedback. People will be honking at you or giving you a lot of negative feedback verbally about your driving skills. Or you'll find yourself starting to feel overwhelmed or avoiding certain roads or certain intersections. Often people actually have a sense of when it's starting to be time to think about not driving, but it's such an enormous part of our identity as an adult that it's really hard to let go of that. On the bright side, a lot of communities will offer no-cost or low-cost transportation for seniors. They will make collectives possible so that they'll do rideshare programs or car share programs. And there often are a lot of opportunities if you start to look into them, but it's better to start looking sooner than later.
And Robert, you talked about living in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. This was a community that had no transit options. So is it possible you may decide that you can't age in place in the place you're living now because you simply couldn't get around when things got harder?
Yes. And in fact, that was part of our thinking as we relocated. We're in our 50s, and we thought in part it would be easier to relocate in our 50s rather than in our 70s. We enjoyed rural living. But it's not an easy place to age. Things you don't think about, like clearing your driveway of snow, are quite a challenge in a place like Gettysburg. Again, if you can't drive, you are stuck. You are stuck at home. And when the larger bus companies stop their Gettysburg stop in the 1980s, there were people, and we were on the Citizens Advisory Council at the Office on Aging. There were people in Gettysburg who literally could not leave town.
Why are some people phobic, do you suppose, Mary, about public transportation? And phobic is the term you use in the book.
A lot of people, both young and older, are extremely phobic about using public transportation, and they'll talk about fear of being stuck in traffic or stuck and unable to get off a train with, you know, bad people on it, or they wouldn't have control over when they could come or go. But if you think about it, often if you're stuck in traffic behind the wheel, you're just as stuck as you would be on a train or a bus or any other conveyance. And there's a lot of phobia about using public transportation because a lot of people feel out of control when they're not behind the wheel.
Ah, so they're not the ones calling the shots and saying we're going to turn here, that sort of thing.
Precisely.
Right. Let's. I want to come back, though, because when we're talking about driving, there's another set of things to think about there, and you do address this in the book. There's advice here on telling memory lapses from something more serious. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. Everyone experiences a little bit of memory slow down, let's say, as we age, and it may take you longer to come up with a date or the name of an object or even a person or a birthday. The fundamental difference between normal memory loss and signs of potentially something more serious is the nature of what you're experiencing. Holding keys in your hand and not being able to remember what they're called is a little embarrassing, but not signs of a problem. Holding keys in your hand and not knowing what those are used for is, again, a red flag. That's a sign of a functional decline. That's a sign that you may not be able to carry out some activities of daily living as you used to, and that's when you may want to talk to your family doc about what's going on.
So knowing the name of something is not as important as not knowing, I mean, as, when you know what it's for, at least, you're still in pretty good shape.
That's right. If you cannot remember what a key is used for or how you turn the stove on or off, that's the sign of a problem.
All right, but and I imagine the same thing comes to people and names when you're saying, I can't remember your name for the life of me, but I remember that great party we had several years ago. If you at least have some sense of association, are you still in reasonably good standing?
Yes, oh, absolutely. Those kinds of memory losses can be inconvenient. They can be a little bit embarrassing, but no one has ever entered a skilled nursing facility because they couldn't remember what day of the week it is or their friend's name. That's not, when you think about it, that's not a problem in living. It's a little embarrassing, but it's not a problem in living. The things that cause people to need a higher level of care are those memory losses that interfere with their ability to take their medication, to cook on their own, to bathe on their own. And so that's really what you want to be thinking about.
Mary, there's a whole section of a whole chapter in How to Age in Place on Healthy Mind. And what are some of the things you recommend to keep the mind active and engaged?
Use it. You must absolutely continue to exercise your mind through whatever vehicles make you happy, be it playing bridge or doing crossword puzzles, interacting with other people, reading, traveling, mentoring, volunteering. There is so much that you can do to maintain your cognitive health. But the most important thing is to maintain an active cognitive life. Keep using it.
Don't stop thinking. Don't stop reading and communicating with people. Here's an email from Stan, no town given. He says, it says a lot, mostly bad, about a society when so much complexity, risk, and uncertainty are thrown on the individual. But is that a fair assessment, Bob Bornstein, or are there more bits of help that we are actually aware of?
In terms of how we've thought about aging, absolutely, it's a good question and it's a good point. It's ironic that aging in place was once the norm. There was a time going back a few decades when everybody aged in place. This notion that you enter a skilled nursing facility and are cared for by strangers is really a vestige of our mobile post-World War II society. Back in the day, when you or I might begin to show some decline and need a little bit of extra help, That's what the kids are for. That's what the grandkids are for. That's what families do. So this is kind of a new thing, and I think society hasn't caught up with it yet. You know, we talk quite a bit early on in the book about the limitations of Medicare. And, you know, just to give one important bit of it, I think many people believe that Medicare will pay for their time in a skilled nursing facility. By and large, it does not.
All right, much to think about. Wish we had more time to talk about it. The book is called How to Age in Place, Planning for a Happy, Independent, and Financially Secure Retirement. It's on 10 Speed Press. Mary Langerand and Robert Bornstein wrote it. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good to have you both. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8, we'll talk to Desiree Young, Kyron Horman's mom, about him being gone for 3 years now. Our Vents Day segment, we'll talk about raising dams and testing in schools, and then we'll talk about the urban bestiary at 9 o'clock, all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.